Welcome back, clinical problem solvers. Maddie and Yusuf here. At CP Solvers, our mission is to make clinical reasoning accessible to learners worldwide. We invite you to join us for our live virtual morning reports, where we break down cases and sharpen our diagnostic reasoning together. Now over to you, Yusuf.
Thanks, Maddie. Just a quick reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only and is not a substitute for medical advice. Patient details have been modified to protect their privacy, and the views expressed here are our own, not those of our employers. Now, let's dive into the case.
Enjoy the show!
Hello, everyone. I'm super excited to be back with the Schema team for another podcast recording. We were just hanging out and talking about life updates before starting. And that's why I sound so happy because, you know, being with these three people really filled my cup. Maddie, how are you doing?
That was the best intro ever. Love the enthusiasm. Totally agree. Hanging out with you guys fills my cup. I'm doing well. I feel like the only updates I give are baby updates. So I guess there's more to my life, but not really. So things are good. Back into residency, hanging out with little Aaron. Life is great. And excited for this case. What about you, Yusuf? Any updates to share with the crowd?
All good. All good. I was just reading about the new hantavirus that may have transmitted from human to human. And now that we've lived through the pandemic, I'm like, oh no, I've seen this movie before. Not again.
Oh gosh.
Yeah. On like a cruise ship in the Canary Islands, and I've been like reading all about it. So I was like, oh my God, hopefully it doesn't spread. Mark, any insider infectious disease news?
Well, building off that, I also saw someone talking about using ivermectin for hantavirus on Twitter. I was like, oh no, not again.
Already?
I thought this was done with. But no, and Maddie, I think this is just going to turn into a baby podcast. Honestly, we're going to do a clinical or a schema series on like neonatal, you know, schemas and common presentations in little babies since we have our little one coming in a few weeks. So yeah, audience, just look out for that transition to the baby podcast.
Maybe we can be sponsored by some diapers or some bottles. Yeah.
I think
open
it's so
for
funny
baby sponsorship.
There's like designer diapers, designer bottles. It's crazy. The whole like baby industry is pretty insane, honestly.
It is so much. Anyways, Yusuf, you have a case for us. So excited.
I've been thinking about this case for a while, and I'm really excited to present it to you all. So I'm going to go ahead and get started. This is a 75-year-old man who has a history of dementia from prior CVA. And he had a ground-level fall where he fell down the stairs. So he was admitted to the hospital, found to have a right thigh hematoma, for which IR was consulted. And IR did an embolization of that hematoma. During that admission, he had decrease in hemoglobin. That was like further drop in his hemoglobin. So he had to undergo another procedure, which was also an embolization. And that bleed was next to the vastus lateralis muscle. And he did well afterwards, was discharged. And then 2 weeks after, he started having tingling in his left forearm. So he had pain in his left hand, along with paresthesias of the left hand, and he felt like weak in that specific hand. So I gave a lot of information. I'm going to throw the mic to Noah. Just like, how do you think about this case? And just get your thoughts.
Yeah, interesting start. And just so I know, was the muscle hematoma on the left side the same side as the arm?
So the initial hematoma was actually in the groin, so it was in the hip area.
Uh-huh.
They did a femoral artery access and did embolization that way. And that was on the right. And this time he's coming with left hand symptoms.
Okay. That's very interesting. I guess it sounds a little bit out of proportion to a ground level fall, the degree of hematomas that this patient had. So if I had him on the first initial admission, I would investigate a little bit to see if he has any predisposition to bleeding diathesis, right? I think the initial workup is pretty easy to obtain, the CBC to look at the platelets, and coagulation studies are very easy things to reach for. Talking to the patient and seeing if he has any history of any other bleeding disorders or bleeding problems, I think it's also will also make a stronger case for a bleeding disorder. So that's how I would approach the initial presentation. I think it's quite odd that he required two embolizations. And it seems like they were kind of spaced apart a little bit. So maybe the first one was related to the ground level four, and then the second one was kind of more distant from the event. So I don't know how to make out of it. And I'd be a little worried. What do you think about the left arm symptoms, Maddie?
Yeah, no, I had a similar thought from kind of the first admission that Yusuf described. Like Yusuf described these two hematomas that developed after a ground level fall. And at first you might think, okay, that, you know, you can get a hematoma after falling. But so I think in first glance, that might be absolutely reasonable. But I love your mention of kind of proportionality and two hematomas, and perhaps the second hematoma was not in the location where he had the fall. That brings into question that these hematomas or bleeding seem out of proportion to a potential inciting event. And so I love that thought of the proportionality and do we need to think about underlying predisposition to bleeding. You know, that was the first admission, but now Yusuf is describing this person coming back and having tingling of his forearm and hand, I believe. And so I think, you know, if I was the admitting hospitalist here, I'd probably be thinking about this new problem entirely separately with, you know, keeping in the back of my mind, oh, this question mark of, is there something going on with bleeding? But I think my reflex thought when someone has tingling and pain in their hand is there some type of compression? And we've talked about kind of neuropathies and plexopathies in previous episodes. So practically, I would be thinking about, is there some type of compression? And if we want to make the stretch to try to combine, oh, if this person has an underlying bleeding disorder and compression, does this person maybe have another hematoma that's compressing on some neurovascular structures in the arm that's causing that the numbness and tingling? So that's where my thoughts went. Mark, what about you?
Yeah, the only thing I have to add is that, you know, I guess that on this admission where the patient has the numbness and tingling, you know, there's a chance I might even just ignore the prior admission just acutely, like in the emergency room, and just say, you know, this guy has a history of vascular disease, has a history of stroke. Yusuf did use my least favorite word, one of my least favorite words in medicine, CVA, because I don't know if that means ischemic or hemorrhagic, and that will help tell me what medications the patient is on too. But the patient has a history of vascular disease and is presenting with unilateral neurological symptoms. So I'm kind of doing my stroke workup honestly in the ED and probably ignoring the prior history acutely. So I definitely want a CT head, right, to see if the patient has any bleeding in their brain, and then, you know, probably if that's negative, go to an MRI, especially if these are, you know, acute unilateral focal neurological symptoms. But I agree with you, Maddie. If we want to marry the prior admission, I would definitely be worried about some sort of compressive neuropathy from bleeding. And yeah, I definitely would be very curious. The only thing I'll add about the bleeding diathesis that, you know, you guys both talked about is that I definitely want to know what medications this patient is on. Like I mentioned, has a history of a stroke. If this is an ischemic stroke, probably is on aspirin. If it was recently, might even be on dual antiplatelet therapy with an aspirin and a P2Y12 inhibitor. You know, if this was a cardioembolic stroke, they might be on, you know, a DOAC or a warfarin. So be very curious about the med list because it's really, you know, the most common cause of a bleeding diathesis. So yeah, Yusuf, I'm very curious about the meds and kind of about the, you know, CT head on this admission and, you know, some of the labs that Noah suggested too in terms of the platelets and the coagulation studies.
I love it. That information will be coming soon. So the patient has a history of an ischemic stroke more than a year prior. His home meds include aspirin, 81 milligrams daily, and gabapentin. And then he came into the ER. His exam was essentially his cardiac exam, his pulmonary exam were normal. There were very notable left upper extremity findings. So he had swelling in the forearm. The compartment felt very firm. There was pain with passive stretch of the wrists and fingers, and diffuse tenderness across the forearm. He had a sluggish capillary refill, and the pulses were faint, but if you put a Doppler on, you could hear the pulses. He had a loss of sensation in his median ulnar and radial nerve distribution. His motor function was intact, but weak secondary to pain. On his right lower extremity, where the procedure was a few weeks prior, it was a little bit firm, but it was like healing well. The rest of the exam was unremarkable. And before I give you more information, Mark, I would love to hear your impression, but I also would love to hear you comment on if somebody's taking aspirin and they fall, how commonly do they have bleeding? And is that common or is that uncommon in your experience?
Yeah, maybe I'll tackle that question second. I just want to talk about like emergencies in the extremities, right? So this could, you know, apply for the arms, the legs, right? But when someone comes in with an extremity complete, there's a few like no miss diagnoses that you want to consider, like an emergency department. This one is screaming compartment syndrome, right? This arm is swollen. We're losing our pulses. We have paresthesias, like emergently contacting whoever in your hospital deals with compartment syndrome. In my hospital, that would be orthopedic surgery. So I would call orthopedic surgery, and I forget what the name of the tool is, but they use this tool to essentially measure the pressures in the compartment in the arm. And if the pressure is above a certain level, that tells them that the pressure is way too high and they might need to take the patient to the OR for a fasciotomy. I think some hospitals, like some of the orthopedic surgeons, don't really believe in that. It's all about like the physical exam, but just call the team that kind of handles compartment syndrome. So that's one. Necrotizing fasciitis is another. Necrotizing fasciitis can be very, very subtle. These patients can go from 0 to 100. They can like not look that bad in their extremity, but maybe have a little bit of crepitus, and then, you know, they're in toxic shock with group A shock bacteremia in like an hour. So that's something else to think about. It doesn't seem like we're really getting any other, you know, features of a, you know, inflammation here, but something to keep in mind. And then just obstruction too, from just like a venous clot and arterial clot. Those are other things to think about. And then of course, I already mentioned the, you know, central causes in terms of like neurologic and stroke. But yeah, I would be talking to our surgery colleagues, and then, you know, likely getting a CT scan of the upper extremity to see kind of what's causing all this swelling. To your question about aspirin. Yeah. You know, aspirin, P2Y12s, rather safe. DOACs, also actually rather safe. You know, you do have to, you know, there's always this concern, like, you know, patient has a lot of falls. Should I take them off their blood thinner, especially take them off their anticoagulation? But there's a lot of studies out there. There's actually a Things We Do for No Reason article looking at DOACs. I think it might have looked at warfarin as well. It was actually from someone, one of our wonderful hospitals at Stanford was one of the authors that showed you have to fall so many times to have like an intracranial event or a significant bleed. I think it's like hundreds and hundreds of times. So really, like, it's always a risk-benefit analysis and a discussion with the patient and the family, but really think twice before you stop a blood thinner, especially if someone, you know, would benefit from it, especially someone that has vascular disease, history of stroke, history of coronary disease. It's not as simple as like, oh, fell once, okay, stop their blood thinner anticoagulation, because, you know, a breakthrough huge MCA stroke could be devastating to the patient, right? So yeah, Maddie, what else do you think? What is this like presentation making you think of?
Use this description, every additional word he said, I'm like, oh my gosh, compartment syndrome. So I love how you walked through kind of the do not miss causes in the extremities. And that's exactly where my mind went. And getting to kind of know a suspicion of, is there a underlying bleeding disorder here? You know, we have these history of these two hematomas that may be out of proportion to trauma he had. We have this compartment syndrome, and could that be related to kind of bleeding into the fascia that's causing compression of all these structures? So I think practically what we need to do as the providers taking care of him is, you know, addressing this compartment syndrome and relieving that pressure as soon as possible. And then we can think a little bit deeper as to why he got this in the first place. And I think, you know, one question I would be interested in is the question of trauma to that arm, and what were the circumstances kind of leading up to the pain in this arm.
Awesome. Great discussion, you all. And I love teaching that, Mark, especially like not stopping anticoagulation just because of falls. And you need to have like a really serious reason to stop an anticoagulant. And if you ask patients, would you rather bleed or have a stroke? Almost every single patient I've ever had prefers a bleed. So I think if we want to follow what patients want, we should do that as well. So I'll give you some more information. So white count, 13. Hemoglobin is 8, low. The MCV is 97. Platelet count, 500,000. His CPK, 7,000. Creatinine, normal. Electrolytes, normal. Surgery, they come and see him. Take him to OR immediately. They perform a fasciotomy. And while performing the fasciotomy, the patient has severe oozing of blood inside the OR. And in the OR, they review the labs, and he actually has a PT that is normal and a PTT that is markedly elevated at 80. So they actually consult hematology from inside the OR. And in the OR, they call him, and he was like, okay, let's do some fresh frozen plasma, some tranexamic acid, some prothrombin complex, and they complete the OR safely. So I'm going to stop there and throw it to Maddie.
Oh my gosh. I'm worried about this patient. And first of all, I didn't know you could consult hematology from the OR. That was news to me. But I think, you know, right now we really, I'm concerned about bleeding in this person, obviously. And so let's maybe try to break down why people bleed, and then we can try to localize why he's bleeding. So I, you know, in clinical reasoning, we love kind of an anatomical approach, and I think that works well also for bleeding. And so I think of, if you're bleeding, there would be a lesion either in the blood, and you can think of the components of the blood, including platelets and coagulation factors. So is it a lesion in the blood? Is it a lesion in the vessel wall? And that can be either an inflammatory process like a vasculitis or a non-inflammatory vasculopathy. Or is it an issue with von Willebrand factor, which you can think of as kind of what connects the two between the vessel wall and the components of the blood? So again, think of, is it an issue with the blood, and is it an issue with coagulation factors, platelets, vessel wall, or von Willebrand factors? I think for this person, what we've heard is the PTT is prolonged. And if we all, you know, it's helpful to just look this up. But if you, you know, type in the coagulation cascade, if you recall, there's the intrinsic pathway and the extrinsic pathway. The PT is a part of the extrinsic pathway, and the PTT is a part of the intrinsic pathway. And so this person with the prolonged PTT, I'm worried, has a lesion in the intrinsic pathway. And maybe I'll pass the mic to Noah if you want to talk more about, like, in him with this elevated PTT, where you think the lesion could be within that.
That was a beautiful explanation, Maddie. Before going into a little bit about the bleeding disorder, to recap, so we have a patient that had trauma, had a fall, and then had multiple hematomas, and now he's presenting with this compartment syndrome. And the compartment syndrome, you can think of the presentation much like acute limb ischemia. It's pulseless, it's painful, but the main difference, it's going to be tense and it's going to be swollen. And the compartment syndrome, it's basically because you have like this inelastic fascia, and then something is increasing the pressures inside the fascia. And in our case, we opened it up and we saw it was blood. It could be pus, right? It could be a bone that's broken and that's bleeding. It could be a clot that's preventing the blood flow to get back. But in our case, the patient is bleeding inside his fascia. So with the PTT being elevated, that puts us into the pathway that Maddie described. And the next step in the investigation would be to do a mixing study. And the reason why we would do a mixing study is because if we get blood that we know it's not diseased and we mix with the patient's blood, if the patient's blood has a deficiency in one of the coagulation factors, that deficiency will be corrected by the fresh, non-diseased blood. However, if we let the blood incubate for a while and the deficiency initially corrects, but then it starts becoming apparent again, we can determine that actually what is happening is that the patient's blood has an inhibitor to one of the factors, and that's causing that factor to have decreased activity and the PTT to be increased. So that's what I would recommend in that case to doing a mixing study. And just thinking about the epidemiology, this patient's an older patient. It's most likely that he has an acquired disorder. In that case, the mixing study can initially be corrected, but then the PTT will be prolonged later again. Mark, what are the factors that we should be looking at?
Yeah.
No, even your dog is scared of the coagulation cascade. Sorry, back to you, Mark.
No, you're good. I love having Noah's dog in the background. So I just want to summarize just like Noah did. So Maddie, you know, took us through the journey of bleeding, which was awesome. And then Noah, you know, talked us through the mixing study, which is not an easy thing to explain over a podcast. So kudos to you. I think my suspicion is for an acquired factor inhibitor is also really high as well. Just like you said, given the age, right? Like the most common cause of acquired factor inhibitor is factor VIII, right? And we don't think a person at this age has hemophilia, right? That would be another, you know, cause of, you know, factor VIII deficiency, but that would be a congenital cause, but that, you know, that occurs in childhood. So, you know, you can have factor IX, you know, factor X, factor 11, factor 12. You can have all those inhibitors as well, but it really is factor VIII is by far the most common. And, you know, I actually had a case similar to this maybe like 6 months ago. And it really taught me that coagulation studies are chronically ignored. Like they're always ordered on admission. And a lot of times they'll be abnormal, but like no one really comments on them. Like I had a patient that, you know, got coagulation studies for a procedure. I took care of the patient like weeks and weeks after. They got a procedure and the PTT was very high, but no one commented on the PTT at all. They got their procedure. They had bleeding complications. No one commented after that. And then weeks down the line, the patient had a spontaneous retroperitoneal hematoma. And then they got coags again for the first time in a few weeks. PTT was super, super high. And they wind up having an acquired, you know, factor VIII inhibitor. So I think when someone's bleeding, do not ignore the INR PTT. It can really tell you a lot and it can help you localize the lesion. And, you know, I learned a lot from that case that I previously had that I just explained. And, you know, really like 50% of cases of factor VIII inhibitors are idiopathic. We're not really sure why they can happen in older people, but they just happen. You know, patients present similar to, like Yusuf is explaining, some intramuscular hematomas. And you know, we just treat, you know, supportively with factors. But you got to be on the lookout for the other 50%, right? And it's the common triggers that we know and love, malignancies, autoimmune diseases, less likely infections. But really the most common autoimmune disease is really lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. And then malignancies, really, they span the whole spectrum of malignancies, but lymphoproliferative malignancies are a little more common than solid malignancies to cause factor inhibitors. So for me, you know, I would do exactly like Noah said, do the mixing study. See what factor is down or which one we have an inhibitor. And then you can do a review of systems for autoimmune diseases and then start sending some, you know, basic labs and possibly some imaging for malignancy as well. But yeah, we got a really interesting case. So what happened next?
Wow. Your discussion is like an expert discussion. So you all are doing amazing. So the patient did not have a history of bleeding prior to these events, has had procedures in the past that went well. And hematology recommended sending the workup, like you all said. So a mixing study, fibrinogen level, factor 8, 5, 10, 13, and von Willebrand studies. Because there is a version of von Willebrand disease that causes a factor 8 deficiency. And I'll talk about that shortly after we finish the discussion. So his factor 8 level was extremely low, almost undetectable. Fibrinogen level was normal. The mixing study was done, and there was no correction with mixing. The von Willebrand's factor level was within normal limits. There was a normal ristocetin cofactor activity that Mark wanted in aliquot 1. And all the other coagulation factor levels were within normal limits. And I'm going to pause here for like final discussion or what would you all do next?
Well, I think at this point, you know, given the teaching that Noah gave on the mixing study. So you said, so factor 8 was extremely low, right? So just from that, we know that there's either a deficiency or an inhibitor. And then we get to the mixing study. And so when you combine the patient's serum with like normal plasma, it does not correct. Is that right? So that based on Noah's teaching points to me that there is an inhibitor because this inhibitor is kind of preventing the factor 8 from functioning even when you mix it. So to me, I'm concerned that this is like an acquired factor 8 inhibitor. Noah, Mark, is that also you, the way you're thinking about this. I think, you know, Mark, you're teaching about like 50% being idiopathic, 50% being triggered by something else. I'm curious how you think about, would you do further workup at this point to try to investigate if there's an underlying driver, or how would you go about that?
Tube of truth.
You would do CT?
Yeah, I'd probably get a PAN scan. I mean, you know, obviously, if the patient can, you know, give us some focality in their symptoms, you know, if they've been having some chronic cough or some chronic GI symptoms or anything like that, that'd be helpful to, you know, focus in our evaluation. I'd definitely be asking them about, you know, prior cancer screening. Did they get their colonoscopies? Are they someone that, you know, was a population that would benefit from prostate cancer screening? But honestly, like, especially with this severe presentation and just like the patient's older age. And I would also be investigating the stroke a little more too, because, you know, UC System didn't tell us that this patient had hypertension, hyperlipidemia, diabetes, smoking. He just told us that they had a history of stroke. So I'd be curious when that happened. And was that a hint that this patient had a hypercoagulable state in the past, which, you know, as we know, in older patients, cancer is the most common cause. It probably wouldn't like influence the workup, but it would just be interesting if that was the kind of first manifestation of like a malignancy was a stroke. And now we have a factor inhibitor. But I think at the end of the day, like you probably need, you know, a PAN scan just to see if you can, you know, identify anything. And then, you know, things like, you know, myeloma as well. So I would probably do a paraprotein workup as well. Because Yusuf did tell us that MCV was like, I want to say like 97 or 96. We love macrocytosis and MCV here in Clinical Problem Solvers. And, you know, a lot of paraprotein disorders like myeloma and other ones can cause a macrocytic anemia. And maybe that was just, it's possible that was just from, you know, a reticulocytosis from a patient that was, you know, bleeding possibly, or they have, you know, B12 deficiency or something else like that for an unrelated reason. But yeah, I'd probably do PAN scan and a, you know, paraprotein workup to start. And, you know, LBH as well could be helpful. And then we'll ask Noah, you know, for any other thoughts, but maybe the hardest question about treatment, because I know Yusuf is putting in the chat. Yeah, any other thoughts, Noah, and then tackling treatment maybe?
I was about to ask you because I have no idea. It would make sense to give factor VIII in my head, right, to a patient that's bleeding. But I'm worried that if the patient has an inhibitor, isn't that just going to inhibit the factor VIII that I'm giving the patient? So I was actually going to ask you all to see if anyone had experience in treating those patients. Yeah. And if it is idiopathic, or if we're doing the investigations and we don't find a cause, since it's an antibody, is immunosuppression indicated in those cases?
Yeah, I'm excited to give you all some more information. So in this case, they did end up getting a PAN scan that was normal and SPEP was normal. So it was and then they sent a inhibitor titer, which is the Bethesda inhibitor titer, and his titer was very high, basically diagnostic of a factor VIII inhibitor. So his, especially given his new spontaneous bleeding, very low factor level, very high inhibitor level, and normal von Willebrand's factor level, that's virtually a diagnostic of the disease. So I have a few teaching points. So I'm going to tell you what happened to this patient. So this patient was actually treated with the recombinant factor VIII and then cyclophosphamide, rituximab, and dexamethasone. The patient underwent a graft, skin graft, and then actually did pretty well and was discharged from the hospital to subacute rehab and was able to follow up outpatient. And I have a few teaching points. There's a NEJM paper from 2016 on this topic that this first line is like iconic, so I'm going to repeat it here. Heme modules in medical schools teach about TTP and AML as the heme emergencies. Factor inhibitors should be added to that list. So it's just as ominous. So it is diagnosed with an isolated elevated PTT and failure to correct with a mixing study. And then von Willebrand's disease, type 2N, can mimic hemophilia or acquired hemophilia. So you want to make sure that the von Willebrand's factor level is normal. And then, like Mark said, it can be idiopathic or associated with autoimmune disease, malignancy, and advanced age. And as you know, idiopathic means we just don't know yet. We'll probably find out in the future. Once this is diagnosed, this is an emergency. These patients can bleed. And I was talking to my friend who's a hematology fellow. Whenever somebody has an acquired hemophilia, you actually go back to every single procedure they've gotten recently, and they're probably bleeding from that site. So if they recently had a colonoscopy, they're probably bleeding from that colonoscopy. Then IV, they're probably bleeding at that site of the IV, and like the bleeding doesn't stop. This is an emergency. So you can check the Bethesda inhibitor titers to check the inhibitor level. And then the treatment is tells you how serious this is. So you stop the bleeding, so you give the recombinant factor 8, but then you also want to eradicate the inhibitor. And this is with way more than steroids. So it's steroids, rituximab, and cyclophosphamide. And now there's like a easy like there's a new recombinant factor 8 that can be given. And that's the end of the case. Love to hear your reflection.
Yeah, Yusuf, this was an awesome case. Thank you for presenting. I think one of my I also love the line that you repeated about how it should be on the list of our kind of heme emergencies that we think of. And to that point, you know, I love what Noah mentioned at the beginning is kind of when to be suspicious of this and when you see bleeding that seems to be out of proportion to any trauma. I think that is one reflection of when this should maybe, when an antenna should be raised and when you should just send coagulation studies. And then to Mark's point, you know, following up on those coagulation studies and not ignoring a prolonged PTT. And I feel like, you know, PT, like INR, PTT are so easy to send and they can really kind of catch these life-threatening diagnoses. So low threshold to send those coags.
Actually, I was talking to Zavin about this at SHM recently, is that one thing we don't teach in school or residency is what labs must be explained. Or what labs are pivotal. Like you can ignore a low chloride, but you can't ignore a low SAG ascites. Yeah. Similarly, like you can ignore like a mildly elevated INR and with a presumed vitamin K deficiency, but you can't ignore like a PTT that's double. And I think that's an area that maybe it's an area of growth in medicine. Like maybe we can teach pivotal labs where like it's always the pivot or must be explained.
I love that.
I feel so bad for chloride. It gets no love. I feel like it only gets hate and just gets ignored.
Your chloride biggest fan, Mark.
I love all electrolytes equally, honestly.
You're going to be the attending that always wants the chloride reported on rounds.
Absolutely.
Don't skip that lab.
He's already the attending that wants.
Chloride, the Pendrin channel. Come on, all of it. All of it's great. But I think, yeah, I think Noah's point, like you mentioned, Maddie, like the law of proportionality. I will say, though, that like, you know, you will always have a PTT in a platelet count, right, on admission. You should, right? I always tell like residents this, too. It's like, you know, they'll be presenting a case and it's some bleeding and the patient doesn't have coags in the term. Like, this is the first lab that should be ordered on admission in the ER when someone's bleeding. A PTT, an INR, and a platelet count. That's just like the first labs that should be ordered. And if they're bleeding, obviously, like a type of screen and if you need to, you know, transfuse them. But then if the PTT is super elevated, it kind of like relieves you of that stress of like, oh, is this like out of proportion? Was this trauma out of proportion? They're bleeding. Because to Yusuf's point, a elevated PTT cannot be ignored, right? You have to work it up whether it was like, you know, in proportion with their trauma or out of proportion with their trauma, because it's always abnormal, especially if you repeat it and it's persistently abnormal. So just always look at that coags. And yeah, Yusuf, I feel like we should definitely talk offline about that, like what almost like a new lecture series about like what, yeah, pivotal labs, which ones can't be ignored. I like that.
Only if we cannot include chloride.
We'll talk about that offline too.
Yeah, I love this case. I feel sad for the patient because it seems like a pretty life-changing diagnosis. And my main takeaway, I think it's how scary you made the factor deficiency sound. And like just the degree of immunosuppression you have to give those patients show like you have to take this very serious.
For sure. That's a wrap, folks.
That's a wrap, everyone. Thanks for tuning in.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to be part of our community, join us for our live virtual morning report, where you can present the case or discuss with us. Visit our website for details. We would love to have you.